Access number 28671, Mr. Ronnie Wheatman, Reel 8. Now, what happened when you got back to Kalyan then? This is late June, early July. We're not quite sure about
now,
that.
Then we were given 10 days holiday to run there. And we went to the YMCA, we booked in. And we had a look around Bombay, and wherever you went, of course, it was very cheap. And we looked at everything, the gateway to India and all the various things, the two places, the snake charmers and mongoose fighting the cobras and this, that and the other on every street. We went to pictures, we had food, and we really did enjoy ourselves. We dressed in civilian clothes, and we ran out of money. So we didn't know what to do. And we got all the military police, and they could tell us there's an RAF detachment in Bombay, and there was at a place called Malabar Hill, which was air headquarters. So off we trundled there. There were, I think there was about 14 of us. And we went, and we told them that we'd run out of money. And they said, oh yes, we can give you some money. And they gave us X amount of rupees. We had to sign for it, but we hadn't got a hat, so we had to borrow a hat, because to salute, when you get your money, you've got to have a hat. So we borrowed a hat from one of the airmen, and each one plonked it on the head and signed and walked away with this amount of money, which kept us going for the rest of our holidays.
Now, where did you go back to?
Went back to Kalyan.
Is that where all your lads were now?
No, no. From Kalyan, we were then drafted on Operation Amber, which was into islands off the Borneo coast.
So the same islands, or?
No, this is Borneo, not... this is Burma, sorry. Burma. Off islands off Burma. Next to, I think it was Ramri or Akiab or something like that. But they were islands that we had to set up radar. So off we set.
So again, this is with a special, a wireless operating unit of the SAS.
This was radar.
This is radar.
This is back to radar. And the number that we were given was AMS 6367. Ministry Experimental Station 6367. And we went then to these islands. It took us about 8 days from Bombay, right around Ceylon and up past Madras and off from Calcutta and along the coast. And the Navy took us in to these islands, and there'd be about 300 troops with us.
And do you know which island you're actually on? Were you on Akiab?
Either Akiab or Ramri, I can't remember now. And we had to set up our radar gear.
Now, how did you set the gear up?
Well, the gear was set up on the top of vehicles again, precisely mounted, and it was Type 64, a goat, and we set up. And we'd been there about 3 days, and the Japanese started shelling us furiously. It's evident that whoever said that there were no Japanese in the area, the information was false, because we incessantly blasted out.
Now, what was it like being under shell fire like that? That must have been quite new, very
frightening, because you had to dive out of your cabins that you were in on these trucks, and get down in holes in the ground, because some of them were very near. And we were there for, I think, it wasn't more than about 4 days. And then, the craziness was, we were told that we had to leave our equipment, set it on fire, blow it up, and that we would be taken off. And the force that was there, there was only, I think, to be about 500 altogether with army personnel. And we were all loaded back onto these ships. All our trucks were set on fire and left. The gear was left there, destroyed, because there were all sorts of detonating charges had to be placed and ignited. This was done by the army. And we all, the whole flotilla, there'd be about 14 ships, went back, all the way back to Bombay. So Exercise Amber was a farce.
And this is all in July, 45?
This is all in July. When we got back to Calais,
From Ceylon, you went to Calais.
Yes, back round from these islands off Burma, the flotilla went all the way around Ceylon, because Ceylon is at the bottom of India, and then up to Bombay, and back to Calais. When we got to Calais, it was coming up to, into July, middle of July. We'd only been back 2 days, and we were told that we were going then into another operational zone, which was into Malaya. And that operation was called Exercise Zipper. Now, the equipment that we were going to have on there was a duck and 2 3-tonners, 3 1,500-weights, and 2 jeeps. And that was our force. We got on a troop ship called the Aduna.
Now, are you still AMS 6367?
Still AMS 6367. We keep that number, because that was our sort of radar unit. And we got the vessels themselves, the troops, that consisted of a vast amount of army troops, because it was a great invasion of Malaya.
And it's going to be Exercise Zipper, landing on the main coast.
On the main coast, Exercise Zipper. And off this huge flotilla went out of Bombay, and went down the coast, and we off Ceylon, we were taken over by a vast number of naval vessels. There were 2 aircraft carriers, a huge flotilla, and we went and hove to off the top of Sumatra. Now, we couldn't understand why we'd stopped, because the sea was a mass of mines. There were all the time the minesweepers going up and down and discharging mines, and we were on deck with guns and found that these mines had bobbed up and blowing up with great surges of water. And then we stopped.
Were they Japanese mines, I presume?
They were Japanese mines, yeah. Now, we stopped dead. And we stopped dead for 48 hours. And we couldn't, because it was rather frightening to be in an area in the midst of minefields, or you were protected by minesweepers up and down and up and down. But we wondered what it was all about. And then on the morning, about 9 o'clock, the commanding officer of the boat drew us all together, and he said, "I have some fantastic news for you. The war with Japan is over." Now, not one of us would believe it. He said, "We have dropped 2 bombs on Japan and they've capitulated." We told them to get knotted, because we dropped thousands of bombs on Germany. They didn't capitulate. We had no idea what an atomic bomb was. At any rate, we still had to go ahead and invade, because it was recognised that many of the Japanese forces would not surrender. So then we went in, we were unloaded from this huge, down the side of this huge troop ship, down onto LCI's landing craft infantry, and they took us in to land.
Now, and where did you land?
We landed at a place called Morib Beach.
Where?
Morib Beach. Morib Beach. That's near to Port Swettenham and Port Dixon.
So what happened during the landing?
Now, the landing again was a bloody farce, because a lot of the 3 tonners and 1,500-weight, they were taken in. It was a low flat sort of sandy beach. But the exhaust, you had to keep your foot down and push like Mary out to keep the engine going, because there were places where it was deeper than
the...
Now,
were you in the dock, or were you in the...
No, this is the ducks had been taken off. There were about 10 other ducks, and our duck had been taken off by someone else, and it was waiting for us when we got on land, the beach masters were there controlling all the people coming off, telling you where to go to, that you'll be picked up by 3 tonners of 1,500 weights. And
now, there was no resistance, I presume?
No, none whatsoever. Now, when we got off, we were directed to go to an airfield called Calang.
How do you spell that?
C-A-L-L-A-N-G, Calang. And we had to go there. Now, when we got there, there were masses of Japanese. Now, it was very, very strange to come face to face with the enemy, and they were all in loincloth G-strings, all they had with hats. But we looked at them, the physique and everything, and they were doing all jobs, helping to set up tents, helping to clear refuse from the side of the aerodrome. And there was quite a few aircraft that landed, especially Dakotas, and the ground was soft. And it was amazing what they did, the British army. They got hundreds of Japanese under the wings and lifted the aircraft. You could do it by 500 or 600 people with hands, literally lift an aircraft. And I've never seen that ever again. And of course, they moved these aircraft out of soft ground. But we were in tents there, and we set up our area where we're going to be, and then we set off to reconnoitre the area where we had to go. We had to find some elevation, and the various parties went off each day up and down the coastline. And I was in the one, I went into one that was north of a place called Kuala Selangor, but the place that we found was this seaside place called Kuala Selangor, and it was elevation of about, I think it was 220 feet, so we had elevation to look out. And I have a lot of, I have photographs of it that were taken, and we the ducks that were with us, there were three of us could drive it, and we set off to go to this place where a reconnoitre party had been. We had to go through villages. Now, the villages, the Malayan people, were very jubilant. They gave us fresh fruit wherever we stopped. And, of course, we hadn't to accept any intoxicating liquor because it was highly dangerous. We hadn't to accept any water. Fresh fruit we could accept, but we had to wash it. But the people themselves were so jubilant that we had arrived. And each village we went to, there were cheers went up. There was sort of all sorts of flowers were put around the houses, and it was a wonderful thing. And when we got to this place, Kuala Selangor, we went up this hill, and the house that we'd taken over was what they call a secondary home for the local French people, because a lot of French people were in Malaya. And we settled in it.
Now, how do you spell Kuala? I thought, sorry, I didn't realize you were going to be settling there. How do you spell Kuala Selangor?
K-U-A-L-A, Kuala Selangor, C-E-L-A-N-G-E-R. And we languished there. Let me see. Went in there in September. We were there till about May the following year. At that time, we set up enormous sort of, we reconnoitred the whole area. A vast amount of aircraft were moving up and down. We contacted the rubber planters that started to move back into their establishments. They came and visited us, and we moved into another establishment higher up, which was the commissioner for the district, his house. Now, I have several photos of that somewhere, because it was a beautiful residence.
And that was near your base at Kuala Selangor?
Yeah, that was near, that was in the confines of Kuala Selangor.
Now, what were you, so what were your living conditions like?
They were beautiful there because we had the in this place they had bathrooms that were tiled because the Europeans lived in absolute. Everything was done for them. They had servants galore. The women did nothing else but drink gin and whiskey. The men did nothing. They worked about an hour a day. They only worked from about 7 o'clock in the morning till eight. The overseers took over, and they literally did nothing. It was just lavish living.
And it was for you as well, living with them.
Well, we sort of had to. We had to have a shift work going because we had to report aircraft.
Now, movement. Tell me what your duties were then.
Well, duties, you see, the radar station was manned 24 hours. And we reported to a base, filter rooms in Kuala Lumpur, which was about 40 miles away. And we had to report all movements of aircraft that were moving up and down the coastline, all British and American and Dutch and Australian. And as I say, we lived there in absolute wonderful surroundings. We met so many people. The rubber planters used to invite us to their homes, to meals.
How did you get on with the rubber planters?
Oh, fantastic. But the wives were the most snobbish lot of people I have ever met in my life. They treated us awful. They used to come only out, they came only out for 6 weeks at a time because they hated the insects, they hated everything about it. But the husbands, of course, when they'd gone back, all the husbands used to rake in some beautiful young girls, 16 and 18, and some of these girls used to say, God, the best hand picked, he said, they're mine. Don't touch them, and that was it. And they were beautiful. They looked after them, but the women, the wives never knew that. They went back to England. They only stopped for 6 weeks, as I said. Conditions were horrible. Now
what were you doing, Juro? So just working shifts?
Working shifts, just reporting aircraft. Now, when we had a vast amount of time off, so what we did, we reconnoitred the area to find what it was all like. And we went out to villages, we met the headman, and the British Military Administration in Kuala Lumpur asked us if any of us wished to assist in British Military Administration work. There were four of us said yes we would, and they gave us a hell of a substantial rise in pay. And what they wanted us to do was to distribute rice to very isolated villages that had done nothing. During our runs through the locality, there were some of the areas with very thick jungle in Malaya, we came across something which was unbelievable to me. We found a leper colony. Now, we were ordered to take, and it was four big, huge bags of rice to this leper colony. And we went. Now, the leper colonies themselves, none of the local people will go near them because they think that they're going to get leprosy. And anyone who has a leper in the family, they just take them and dump them and leave them there to be looked after. And when we got there, there were signs everywhere, this is a leper colony, in Hindustani, Malayan, in Chinese, and we read it, and we thought, well, we could see the track led up this bit of a hill. And suddenly, coming down the hill, we saw two people in white. And as we came towards us, we could see there were nurses. And they came along and they spoke English, and we introduced ourselves and we brought this rice. And we said, well, they said, well, we are here, we look after this leper colony. And we said, we, and there were three of them, but there were only two came down, the other was another one was there. And they were all Japanese nurses. And they do know they'd been there during the whole of the war. The Japanese wouldn't go near it. They left food. The local people left food at the bottom. But I said, well, we've got all this. Oh, well, we will drag it up somehow. I said, no, we'll take it up in our trucks. But with about four Indian troops with us, they wouldn't go up. They wouldn't go. To them, it was, no, you catch leprosy and die and this and that. So we said, right, we'll drive the trucks up. And we got these two women in. They couldn't understand. They said, you are angels, one of them said. And we took these big sacks of rice up. It was awful when we got into where they lived. They had ramshackle huts where people were there dying and in horrible conditions. And where they lived was just an ordinary basher. They had a couple of beds there and mosquito nets and then all sort of medicine that they'd been given. But it was unbelievable to see this taking place in that time of life where they looked after people that were just dying of this dreadful disease. And we said to them, well, who buries them? And they said, well, we do. And they'd already got holes dug everywhere, because they said, some days we are not very well, so when we are well, we dig holes to put the people's bodies in, to wrap them in some cloth of some sort and just put them in, offered some dignified sort of verses towards them. But those people, I can never believe it, and I can't to this day, that they'd been there through the war. And, oh, we said, we'd take this rice and we dumped it where they had to go, and we left them. We made three journeys back to them later on, but that was something that was unbelievable, to come across this leper colony.
Any other experience? That is quite remarkable. Any other experiences?
Yes, when the unit was then transformed from Kuala Selangor to Kuala Lumpur, and there again.
Now, when's this?
This was in 46. This would be about January, February 46. We were folded up there and we went there into Kuala Lumpur. And we'd nothing to do, because there was no work. They said, well, we don't want aircraft reporting now. The duct that we had was handed back to the MT section. Our vehicles, we were allowed to keep a 1,500 weight vehicle. We lived in beautiful accommodation which belonged to the British. And we just had food, we had drink, we were paid, and we set about to do all sorts of things, which to visit Batu Caves, which were in the area. And then they said to us, well, we've got another thing going, British administration. From where you were at Kuala Selangor, we've got four boats in there, which is going on anti-smuggling patrols. It's controlled by an army captain. And they said, he's moving to the quarters where you were, and he goes out for 6 weeks or 8 weeks at a time, pulling up junks and diverting them into the nearest fishing place, and Indian troops were put on board if they were loaded with rifles, because they were always stuck with pinched from camps. So I think there were five of us jumped at that, and because the pay was fantastic, and we went out and...
What was a typical anti-smuggler patrol like?
Well, going out, you went out and there was masses of junks. These junks are beautiful. The cumbersome looking things, but they have quite a lot of room inside them. And when you were going to pull them up, because everyone you pulled up, you'd fire a shot across the bow, pull them up and go on board. Now, some of these were the Chinese realized that they were on a good thing. They were flogging guns everywhere and flogging opium and this, that, and the other that they pinched. And of course, there was near skirmishes occurred time and time again where they were going to open fire on us, and some of them did have engines in which were quite good, and we had to just keep plodding along and overtake them. When we pulled them up and we went inside, of course the inside of these places is again festooned with masses of insects of all sorts, but there was everything laid about, guns and this, that and the other, just laying that they'd pinched and were going to sell. And so we used to put a couple of troops, on Indian troops, on board, and they'd go into the nearest fishing place, and there they'd be charged. But that was a fantastic thing, because we used to pull into some of the islands off Sumatra, and they were paradise in itself. Absolute paradise. People lived there, and when they saw we were British, they treated us with a great deal of respect. And this went on to about...
Anything happened, any particular incident with a junk you remember, or was it all...
Well, of course, some of them wouldn't stop. You had to fire at the sails, and then they would halt, and you had to go on board. But there could have been, time and time again, they had knives where they could have flung knives at us, or anything like that, but it didn't happen. From when we got back, because we made quite a bit of money, and we went...
Now, tell me about the pay. How much extra pay were you getting for this sort of extra work?
The extra pay we're getting, let me see, would be about, I think it was $10 a day extra. And I think a dollar was half a crown or something like that.
So that's a lot of money.
It was. Oh, yes. They paid us very lavish. And, of course, then with rations that we got, and they were very good rations on these boats. My God, they weren't care rations. They were super care rations, which the officers could attain, which was far better than the other ranks. Class distinction again. So from there, I gave lectures to people at Kuala Lumpur on
now
radar.
What were the lectures on?
On radar, because we had to show them what we'd done. And the Chinese were very, very interested. They wanted to come inside and look, and I know a photo's taken of them, showing them off at the race course. We took the race course over at Kuala Lumpur with various units. And then we had to leave Kuala Lumpur, and we went down to Singapore. And Singapore...
Now, when was that?
That was in...
May.
It'd be about May. Singapore was still in a state of horrible... Because there were... The quayside and all the harbours was to them a massive litter. And there was always dead bodies lying about. And where we were, the UNIWAT was at the end of Changi Airport. But Changi Airport in those days was just a load of huts. The air traffic control was just on stilts. And I played cricket on Changi Airport in blazing sunshine, because it was damned hot, they used to say. Mad dogs and Englishmen go out in the midday sun. It was quite true. We were rather reckless. But you were physically fit. And Changi village itself, I used to go and have meals there. I used to swim in the sea there. And I saw the mass of Japanese battleships being taken out from the harbour round the corner, out to sea, and sunk off Borneo into huge depths of water. That was a tremendous sight to see. Huge battleships just going with nobody on board, just pulled by various tugs, and know that that was the end, because they were huge ships. Singapore itself was a mass of people, all realised and entered. It was a different era that they were coming into.